But little by little, less people had large animals. And so pretty soon, there were no more large animals in the community. So now I'm really trying to figure out what to do with the building that I built. It's 150 feet long and 12 feet wide, has 9 tack rooms and stalls for 9 large animals. So a place to store your feed and whatnot, your tack, and a place for the animal. And then they all had paddocks as well. But right now it's sort of in disrepair because I'm trying to figure out what to do with it, that it could still help me make a little income. But I opened an office in Garberville to do the nutrition consultations, and I love doing this work because I seem to have a knack for figuring out what is the underlying issue. When people have gotten frustrated with either mainstream medicine, or even if they haven't gone that route, just trying to figure out what's going on, I just am very systematic. It's not really... like I have some special powers. It's like, okay, if it's your GI tract, let's look at what's going on in the GI tract. And so we look for bugs. We look for bacteria, yeasts, and parasites. If it might be a gluten issue, which is more and more acknowledged and recognized nowadays. And I try to find the best labs and the cheapest labs so people can not go bankrupt while they're trying to figure these things out. And so I've been able to help so many people. And another thing that's not on the radar in many clinics is Lyme disease and the multiple ways that Lyme expresses. It doesn't have to be joint pain. It can be mental issues, you know. And so I just have my radar out when I see people for all these different things. And I ask them, well, have you considered that you might have Lyme disease because you have some of the issues that could be related to that? And if not, then I try to get them the proper testing with the best lab, because you don't want them to do an inferior test and say, oh, I'm negative, and then give up on it. So you want the most in-depth testing you can do right now, which we don't look for the bugs themselves still. We're looking at the immune reaction to the bugs. And so you want to go with the best lab for that. And the one that we have is Igenix down in Palo Alto. And then, of course, there's the issue of the co-infections. A lot of people don't realize it's not just Lyme. There are also all these other things you can get from ticks and maybe from other bugs, too, you know. Anyway, I am pretty comprehensive for looking at what could be the underlying issues for a person. Heavy metals is a big one because nobody seems to test for that, but I do. And I find people off the chart in lead and mercury, sometimes arsenic, cadmium. You know, it's important to know, because the great thing is you can get them all down, and it's important to start looking for where the contamination is coming from. Is it your plumbing? A lot of these old houses still have lead pipes, or they have lead solder. Even the taps can be lead. And even Consumer Reports did a study on taps, expensive taps, and how that since they're cast of pot metal, a lot of them contain toxic minerals, toxic elements. So anyway, looking at things like that, I look at the adrenals and the thyroid. Often people say, oh, my thyroid is fine. But no, the doctor only looked at TSH or TSH and T4. They didn't look at the further metabolites and the autoimmune markers. And so often, even when people have been seeing their doctor for a long time, and I just see all these signs of low thyroid, and get them to test the autoimmune markers, antithyroglobulin and antithyroid peroxidase, they come back positive. And so somebody's been missing something all along, and so then finally they can start really working on it. So that's what I enjoy. In fact, one of my my way to say hero is Nancy Drew, and so I say I'm the Nancy Drew of health issues here. It's being a bit of a detective for people. But I was going to say it only works if people want to work on it, you know. And so if we're on the same page, like, yeah, let's find out what's going on, then it works. Because I'm not the kind of person that says, oh, well, take this and take that. You know, they have to be engaged, too, to want to find these things.
If you were going to look back over this arc of time, this 50 years that you've been doing this here, is there, this is not an easy question, but is there an experience that just epitomizes for you, that is emblematic of of what it felt like to be here doing that.
Doing what?
Doing this, doing, making a life out, carving a life out of a wilderness like this, the way that you have in the community that has grown up around you, of time that you just thought, that you remember feeling most alive, most fulfilled.
Well, I'm the kind of person that likes to do something if I can see that nobody's doing it, and I'll jump in and do it. But if I see that a lot of other people want to do it, I'm glad to back off, but I'll find something else. I don't know if that's part of the Sagittarian thing, but I like to just go with my energy for something. Sometimes it's hard to work in groups because you have to hash everything out so much. So I have to say that back in 73, there was a huge fire that started in Edersburg and went all the way to Shelter Cove. It was called the Finley Creek Fire, and it burned the northern side of Whale Gulch. And the law enforcement came to tell us all to evacuate, and we were told that there was going to be a backfire set at Four Corners. And that was the moment when I rose up and said, no, you're not, you know. And that was the beginning of my being involved with fire. Now, I never knew I was going to have a be involved with fire, but because nobody else was doing it, I went into the phone, called CAL FIRE, and said, there cannot be a backfire at Four Corners because there's a whole community between Four Corners and the top of the ridge. You can't see it from the road on the whole, but there's probably 50 houses in this area. And so they didn't. But that started me off on being the fire person, and I've been ever since. I mean, as young people grew up and wanted to be become a fire chief, I back off gladly, and I'll just be an assistant and the desk person and whatnot. But I have done all the trainings and have been the first on scene for many things, and the medical things, I've done it all. I mean, we've had SIDS babies, we've had over-the-bank deaths and all that stuff. And, you know, nobody else was really that involved back then. But I have to say, a lot of the younger people have risen up and wanted to get involved. And that was one of the things I loved about working at the school, was if you could get kids into community service, it was great because they would stay with it. They would see that it made them feel good about themselves. And so a lot of the kids here have grown up and become first responders, done fire training, and gotten into the community service. So we're lucky that our fire department has 21 people on it right now, and it's a small community, but that's because of all the young people, pretty much mostly young. A few are more my age. I'm 73 now, so there's one person, I think, in his 50s or 60s, but the rest are younger now, and they have children of their own who are growing up and will one day be on the fire department, I hope. So they're in their 40s, their 50s, but yeah, we have plenty of people on the fire department. So that's been, that's more my ongoing passion right now. I love doing the health work too, but it's not front and center. Excuse me. Like being involved with the fire department right now. So I guess I would say that is, but pretty much, no, it's my community, really. That's what it is. It's doing, putting my energy into things that can benefit the community. I love doing that. And maybe it's my way of making a family. I feel like with my two kids, that's, I sort of made my own family because I had lost mine so young. And so the community is my greater family in a sense. So I love thinking, seeing things that need doing that nobody else is doing, and just somehow making them materialize. I wrote a grant recently for a fire truck that we have. It's a quick attack fire engine that required basically writing a book. Oh my God, it was from the government surplus, but you had to document so many things. And anyway, I got through all that and they granted it to us. So got that. And oh, way back in the day, this was probably in the 70s, I wrote a grant for what charges the air bottles that you wear when you go into structure fire. And we didn't have one of those, it's a machine that pressurizes air bottles. It's not oxygen, it's just regular air. But they're specialized machines because they can't have any lubrication with petrochemical. It's special oils and whatnot. And the closest place that you could do that was up in Eureka. But what if the freeway was out? What if there was some big event where the bridges fall or something? So anyway, I took it upon myself to write that through the Southern Humboldt Fire Chiefs Association, and it was granted. And so I had never written a grant before, so I was like, oh, yay, this is not that bad. So that sits at the Cal Fire in Garberville. It's getting old now. It needs a little work and maybe replacement at some point, but that was my first bigger community effort. So that's what I love doing. That's what fires me up. Anything I can see that needs attention in this community, if there's no one else to do it, I like to do it.
And as you look back, was there a downside to the choice that you made to be here? Was there a downside to this, to living in this kind of community in this way?
Well, you know, a lot of us started growing cannabis back in the day. I mean, we were, I think, the originals, the first ones that knew what Cienzamillo was. And now we're a bunch of old grannies. And people don't realize that all these young people are taking over everything. They think, oh, they're so hot. But actually, we're the originals. Anyway, we were very clandestine. We hid everything very well. But this was one of the favorite places for camp to practice on. And so there were some heavy times. I mean, the helicopters broke down the tops of my orchard's fruit trees. That's how low they were. And often families didn't even sleep in their homes. They'd sleep out somewhere so that they could run if the helicopters came and that kind of thing. They terrorized us, you know. And what we're talking about is small patches. I mean, maybe a dozen plants spread out a big area and in bushes and things like that. And so, yeah, that was a heavy time. So I'm glad that we don't have that now. But, oh, boy, it certainly is a big conundrum how to make it all work out. Yeah. And what else? Well, because we're so far from law enforcement, sometimes there would be crazy stuff happen that law needed to be involved in, and we have to wait for law enforcement to come from Willits. So that's a couple hours. Yeah. So there have been a few people who have died, who, you know, murder and things like that. And not that much, thankfully, but some. And so that's been hard. You know, we chose to live that far out so that we'd have to police ourselves, basically. And on the whole, that's how it is. But sometimes people get crazy for whatever reason and things go awry. So, yeah, there's that. And then there's the distance thing. As I get older, you know, just driving to town more than one time a week is hard because it's 45 minutes to an hour to get to town. And so I don't go to a lot of functions that I might otherwise. I like to support the arts and if I can and whatnot. And so you spend a lot of time alone. I do, but I like being alone. I love to read and I have Netflix by mail, watch some movies and things like that. But I can envision a time when I might want to live closer to a town. But I'm so devoted to this land. I mean, every little bit of work that's happened on this land was pretty much from my body. And I could tell you stories all over this land, this here and this there. And so I don't know how it's all going to end. I would love to just die in my bed if I could. But if I start to not be able to do my firewood and whatnot, then I'm not sure how I'll manage. I might take in a boarder, somebody to help me. I think of different things, and we all do at this age. You know, we're all getting up in age, and quite a few people are selling their land and moving to towns. And I think, should I be doing that too, or can I hang out here longer? I would like to stay here until the end. So we'll see. I just don't know. Fortunately, I have support from especially my daughter up north, and so in that she and her husband helped me do things when they come down to visit. And I did put up a cabin for each of my daughters on the land so that they always had a place to stay here on the land. It was sort of sneaky of me, I guess, because it had the ulterior motive of having them have a connection to the land, because I could see that they were both of my daughters were more citified. They wanted the goodies of a town more than living out here, but their houses out here draw them back. So we have that, some support. And this house was not that winter worthy. We didn't know exactly how to use insulation to the best advantage and whatnot back in the day. So nowadays I've done some things to make it less leaky. I've put in some double pane windows, but I'm still working on it. Put some insulation in the ceiling, but it didn't have, it just had air cavities before, which was based on a book that I had read called Your Engineered House, which I do not recommend because he just had dead air spaces everywhere without insulation and it didn't really work. So, so being in a sort of a drafty old house sometimes is hard, but the little upgrades have been making a difference. Yeah.
How do you think your choice to be here? I mean, you are already a it seems like an unusual, kind of unique character coming out of your background. But how the fact that you chose to be here, that this was where you chose to be, this intuition to come to Whale Gulch and buy property here and stay here, how has that shaped who you are? How has that helped who you are blossom?
Well, I guess just being, having to rely on myself for everything. You know, I'm my own plumber, my own everything. I do hire somebody for electric because I don't feel so confident with something you can't see. I like plumbing because you can see the water flow. and carpenter, when I started building, I started building my kitchen. My kitchen was just a bunch of crates when we first moved in, and the only cook stove was wood, just a wood stove with a wood oven. And my husband left, and I thought he was gone for good. He had another girlfriend somewhere. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to build my cabinets. Well, I built the cabinets I have, and they have some good stories too. I got the plywood for my drawers from a guy had moved in down the road who built an acid factory, and he was into dosing people, including kids. And the community, not that we were that many at the time, but we rose up and we said, no, this isn't appropriate, and we drove him out. Well, so I knew that there was this plywood back there, and it was a winter when nobody was around. And I took the four-wheel drive truck back to disassemble the acid factory to get the plywood. And the plywood had these big purple stains on it. I knew that was the acid that had spilled, you know. And I've told people, if you wanted to get high in acid, you could lick my drawers. Anyway. And then if you look at my kitchen cabinets, you'll see they have squiggly cuts. Well, I drove those boards into Gopherville, which is 20 minutes away, in order to use this jigsaw I'd found at the dump to cut the curves. So, you know, always when you're building something, there's a balance between being expeditious and getting things done quickly and efficiently versus going with your imagination and doing the fun things and more artsy things. So I feel like this house is pretty good balance. I did, even though I was trying to get that kitchen built, I did squiggles and whatnot. And I taught myself carpentry with no generator. You know, it was only a handsaw. Everything was hand. I had the brace and bit to drill holes and everything hand. Some of those tools from the old junk man in town, because people didn't have all the power tools they have now. Now everybody uses generators, but back then it was just everything by hand. So it took so long to build this house. I just had to stay focused to get it done. That deck is a ferro cement deck, and nobody had ever built anything ferro cement that I knew of, but I knew a mechanic in town who had built a boat. He fished, actually, with us out of Noyo. What was his last name? I can't think of his last name at the moment, but anyway, he built a cement boat, which seems like an oxymoron, but and it did sink. Anyway, he gave me his recipe for the ferro cement, and so I wanted a deck that would be waterproof and wouldn't leak, and would be fireproof. And so I ventured to do this deck, and sure enough, it worked. So anyway, I like, you know, thinking of new things to do that people haven't done before and trying to see if I can invent them. If I hadn't lived here, what would I have done? You know, I might have been some kind of research scientist in my father's footsteps, and probably something to do with health. My mom, I have to say, she was overly sensitive to other people's issues and their pain in a way. Like, she just got so sucked in by other people and the things that they would go through. And I have that to an extent, you know, too. So I would probably be doing that kind of research. My mother's father and grandfather met at a TB sanitarium, and I have my grandmother's journals from that time. And, you know, they faced death daily, and my grandmother couldn't afford the sanitarium, and so she was taking care of another woman there and being paid by the woman's husband to monitor her and do a lot of the nursing care. And I just read through her journals how every day certain people died and they were carried out. But it was a unique experimental TB sanitarium in Saranac Lake, in upper New York, where basically you sat out in these cold, cold porches and breathed the cold air, bundled up in robes, fur robes that kept your body from freezing, but you breathed that cold air. And she recovered and my grandfather recovered and they got married. So anyway, I have illness and health issues back in my family, and I just like working on these things that are a lot of our families have in the background, and trying to make things better in general.
What do you think the impact of the fact that so many people like you came here to this county 50 years ago and 40 years ago, and so many stayed, who they were and what they did, how did that shape the county? What was it that's in that impact on the county?
Well, quite a few people that came here ended up opening shops in town, and they are fun shops on the whole. There's a bead shop, Garden of Beden. There's my friend Marie opened the Hemp Connection, which was hemp clothing. She used to import the cloth, hemp cloth from China, and sew the stuff herself. And now you can get hemp clothing anywhere. And so she and her daughter run that store. And some of the restaurants were back to the land people that started serving organic food. And we've had co-ops and grocery stores that started selling organic things and having supplements and all of that. There was no such thing here when I came as organic anything. Nobody knew the concept. And so little by little, we've infiltrated town, and I think the town is better for it. I think the people in town would agree, yeah, that it's been a good melding. A lot of the arts come from the Back to the Land people. Every year, there's something called Recycled Youth, where some of the Back to the Land people guide kids in high school in writing their own skits and putting them on. They usually pick an overall theme and then write skits that will fit in, and they act them and do the whole thing. So that sort of sucks those kids into being involved with theater after they finish school. And then for all ages, there's another group that meets and writes skits and acts them. And we all try to support those because they're really fun and unique. I mean, some of them are heavy too, and often they're commentary on our lives as well, but they're special. What else? Well, a lot of the dance groups, we've had various groups that we have one called Feet First, and so people can teach any kind of dance. I used to take folk dancing lessons, and I loved folk dancing, and then I did also study flamenco locally with a woman who was a flamenco dancer, and we had belly dancing, and we had a little troupe here in Whale Gulch of a bunch of the women that would get together. It was fun doing those things together. And we had live music. Some of the people became musicians and did the drumming and whatnot. So we brought a lot of that arts and crafts and businesses that were not maybe the nuts and bolts businesses that every town needs, gas stations and hardware stores, so much as the more frilly things, but they've been fun, although some of them are struggling now because the economy has changed since legalization and we're all trying to see where we land.
And in terms of the politics and the environmental awareness and the activism that not only happened here with you, it sounds like in the early 70s, but happened all over the county. Do you see that as a outgrowth of the people who came?
I do, definitely. Yeah, I do see a lot of the activism was from these people that moved back to the land. And if you were to say that, did we have a general spirituality or religion, it would be preservation of nature, protecting nature, I would say. But how did we all end up with that that belief and that deep feeling? It's more than just, you know, something like going to church. It's like a deep feeling in all of us to protect the land. And we've done so much trying to preserve the salmon. Not that our homesteads maybe don't cause some of the damage. I know roads can. A lot of the roads were actually just using old logging roads, but of course those weren't year-round, and now our own roads are year-round. But we started many groups, Matole Restoration Council, the Salmon Group, Sanctuary Forest, and many other groups, and EPIC, Environmental Protection Information Center. All these groups, a lot of their makeup is back to the land people, and they're all continuing to this day, even though it's been going now for probably 30 or 40 years for some of them. And sometimes it's harder to keep these things going than to form them initially. You have a lot of inspiration in the beginning and everybody's right there with their energy. And then to keep them going, writing grants and having office staff and whatever you need, it's sort of hard sometimes to keep them going. So my hat's off to everybody that's keeping all these groups going. And it's making a difference, I think. Well, the first Creek restoration philosophy was that some of the buildup of old wood that had been jammed together, log jams, needed to be separated so the fish could get through. And then we came to see that actually the fish need some of the wood. So we went from one end to the other, but we formed a community nonprofit called Coastal Headwaters Association so that Richard Ganger could write grants. This was way back in the 70s to start doing stream restoration, because we had some big messes in the creeks, especially Indian Creek, which runs out to the Eel down by Piercy, but also the Matole and other creeks as well. So we were able to employ people to do this kind of on-the-ground work, taking apart these huge log jams with chainsaws and whatnot. And people often had to hike in for miles to get to the work, and they'd camp out. What was my point with saying that?
You were just talking about how much this work has, what it's done, for the community and for the environment.
Yeah.
And you said, if there is a spiritualism in this kind of generation, it's environmentalism.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So is there anything else you'd want to say, Nancy? You've given us so much. But is there something else that as you kind of like sweep your mind over this time and your experience and what it's meant to you and why it matters? Anything else that you would want to talk about?
Well, we weren't the first people to live on this land, you know. And my daughter found an arrowhead in our road cut, actually, a beautiful obsidian arrowhead. And so there are still the original people's descendants living in this area. And they didn't go to a reservation. They're Wailaki Tsingkiyun, or Tsingkiyuni, as Richard says, the proper pronunciation. And I would just like to acknowledge them and that this was their land. Not that they owned land, they believed in the land was everybody's. And so we came in with our Western belief that you own your land and, you know, you have boundaries around it and whatnot. And I've met some of the people and that are descendants. And so I just want to acknowledge them because they were here. And they are here sort of scattered around still. And sometimes they've married the people that came in later, and so now that part has also started mixing, and so we just have a pretty good mix. I just think there's not enough of other cultures here. Sometimes it seems very Caucasian and middle class. Sometimes, even though some of us have lived without much money for some years, but I'd still say middle class, because we weren't coming from deep poverty where we just couldn't see our way out. You know, we've always had some resources that we could turn to. And so we've been really fortunate, I think. I'm grateful to have found this place and have been able to spend my life here. And I love sharing this land with all the animals that live here. There's some of them right out there. Elk from the Sinkyone, which had been native to here. Then they had all been killed off, and there were still the elk up at Prairie Creek. Well, some years ago, they brought back a bunch of the Prairie Creek ones to the BLM land, Hidden Valley, and put them in an enclosure with very high fences. And then eventually, after the females had babies, they took down the fences and let them go. Well, they migrated down to the Sinkyone Wilderness State Park, which is just down the road here. But nowadays, elk migrate up here, and they like to hang out here at my place. So I live with elk fairly regularly. There was one I called Ferdinand because he wasn't with any others. He was just on his own. And he moved in with my llamas in the barn. There were the six llamas and an elk all living together in the barn. And the way I found out was I went down to feed the llamas one morning, and I heard this huge clattering in the barn. Well, there's some cables holding the barn square, and he had jumped up, and his antlers had caught in the cables, and so he was battering the cables. Anyway, he ended up just living here, and he would eat and then lie down and chew his cud, and my dogs and myself and all my friends, we just considered him part of who lived here. We didn't get too close, probably not closer than like 5 feet, because he could just turn his head and get you without meaning to, but there was him. And then a lot of cats have been disappearing. And I think that's mountain lions. I have a neighbor who's very, very knowledgeable about the wild animals around here. He has a game camera, and he saw a mountain lion in his yard in the daytime. And he had a cat that disappeared. And I had some ferals that showed up that now have seemed to have disappeared. And I lost a goat once to one. And so some mountain lions. I've seen ringtail cats, and I saw a fisher once. At least my neighbor thought it was a fisher when I described it. And a loon showed up once, blown in a windy storm off course, I guess, because they don't live here. But anyway, he identified it as a loon. And just different animals. I love being with the animals, and there's always something to look at and something to try to learn from everything. So I guess that's my answer.
Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.